death stalks us, always. From the time we're little children, we know we're doomed to die. We try to push it from our minds and pretend it's not there, but it always is. It could greet us silently while we sleep in our beds 50 years from now, or it could vault us into the void with a crash tomorrow. How our deaths occur is a mystery. That our deaths occur is a certainty. David Robert Mitchell's horror masterpiece, It Follows, personified the stalking nature of death. In the world of It Follows, though, we can hasten our own deaths by having sex with someone cursed to be haunted by the mysterious It. The flip side is that we can also toss off our curse if we pass it on to somebody else. Imagine it, you can save yourself, but only at the expense of another person. You can benefit yourself and condemn them by sleeping with them. But what if the cursed don't tell their partners? What are they forcing on the newly cursed? And what traumas are passed on to victims of those out to save their own lives? Join me, Professors Leslie Hahner and Scott Varda, as we explore the ethics and sexual violence in the 2014 hit, It Follows. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first real episode of Dark Overtones. We did the preview episode last week. This week, I am very lucky to be talking about one of my favorite horror movies of the last several years, It Follows, with I can't believe this exists, but two real experts on the topic of the movie. Both professors at Baylor University, Leslie Hahner and Scott Varda, they came to my attention because they wrote an article on It Follows that dove into it and dove into the themes in a way that I hadn't seen before. So before we jump into these things, Scott, Leslie, welcome, and we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say about the movie.
Thank you so much. We're so excited to be here.
Okay, so before we get started, it's useful for listeners to know a little bit about my guests. I mentioned that you're both professors at Baylor. We're actually both in the same field, which is very rare, although I'm a social scientist in communication. I think you're both more critical scholars, unless I miss my guess. But it's useful to know about my guests and how they kind of came to the space where they're interested in these kinds of horror films. So could you each talk a little bit about yourselves, what you do at Baylor, and kind of what brought you into the horror space? What made you interested in it?
Hi, my name is Dr. Leslie Hahner. I am primarily a scholar of critical visual rhetoric, which means what I study is how visual artifacts in popular culture impact an audience. And sometimes that work lets me study horror films. And I absolutely love horror films. It's a personal preference, but it's also because when I was in third grade, my parents banned me from watching horror films. And that means that I developed probably an unhealthy attachment to watching horror films, but it's worked out professionally. So that means that I get to write about wonderful films like It Follows.
I think a lot of people probably came to horror because of the fact that they were turned away from it. In last week's episode, I was speaking to Mary Wilde about how I came to horror, and it was really just sneaking away from my parents in the video store and looking at the box art on the horror movies. So I think that's pretty common.
Yeah, my name is Scott Varda. I am a rhetorician who studies a myriad of different texts. Unlike Leslie, I have maybe an even wider variety of things that I'm interested in. So a rhetorical understanding of politics, culture, religion, identity, history are all potential areas that I explore. And interestingly, as a sort of the opposite of Leslie, I was not particularly well observed as a child, so I got to watch lots of horror films. And so while I appreciate some, especially campy ones, I don't have the same sort of I love horror, let's watch it all the time that Leslie does. There might be something deeper happening there.
Is that why Leslie was the first author on the fantastic paper the two of you wrote?
Yes. Usually she is the one that drags me into some of the horror-specific ones. So we've also written about Paranormal Activity together, whereas something like Black Panther that we've written about was more of a me pulling her along as a, hey, I want to write about this thing.
And I noticed that when I was looking at the kind of work the two of you do, it kind of spans, between the two of you, it spans quite a bit. And Scott, when I was looking at your work, I saw that a lot of the work that you do is a lot of the movies that you've looked at or the texts that you've looked at, they're more overtly connected to social issues, whereas horror often, I mean, other than kind of like the Romero movies, don't really get connected to social issues. But I think the two of you together were a dream team to look at this movie because of your different perspectives. But it's possible. I don't know at this point. I think It Follows came out in, what, 2014, 2015, to much applause, but it's possible that not everyone is familiar with it, or if they have seen it, they forget some of the key elements. So can one or both of you give kind of a synopsis of the movie about what it's about and what people might have forgotten about it? If you can avoid spoilers, awesome, but in a movie like this, I don't think there's really too much to spoil. It's more about atmosphere and deeper themes than it is about twists and turns. So can you give a synopsis of the way that you read the movie?
Yeah, so the film basically follows a young college student whose name is Jay. Jay goes on a date with a young man named Hugh. After they do dinner and a movie, the two end up having sex in the back of Hugh's car. But later, just about a few hours after that, Jay discovers that she was deceived when Hugh has woken her up, tied up in a wheelchair, and introduces her to the it that will follow her. The it is a slow, zombie-like figure that will kill her if Jay is touched by this figure. The film then follows Jay as she grapples with this ongoing curse and whether or not she chooses to pass it on to another person through sexual intercourse of some kind.
Scott, anything to add?
I think most of my additions there would mostly be around the way that we saw some of those interactions. I think that Leslie gave a really good understanding of what most folks saw. I think my biggest complaint at all would be the have sexual intercourse portion, as I would we would obviously describe that as a different set of relations.
Right.
Oh, we are going to get into these. I cannot wait to talk about this. So, given that synopsis, and I want to come back to specifically your relationship with It Follows, because I think talking about the kind of work that you do, it's kind of obvious what drew you to it. But given your synopsis, like, what do you see? And this is, I already know the answer to your question. I can't wait to hear you kind of vocalize it. What do you see as the major themes in the movie? Because something that, I mean, we can talk about it, but something I think has been talked about ad nauseum about It Follows is that is the STD / STI angle, that the it is meant to be a metaphor for sexually transmitted infections, and it chases down people who expose themselves to it. But what drew me to the two of you was an article that took a different angle. Can you talk about that angle a little bit and what themes you saw?
Absolutely. So we'd written previously together on a number of things, but we'd written also about horror previously. And so we were honestly kind of looking for the next movie that we wanted to write about together. As we watched this one together, we sort of thought it was relatively obvious that this was an allegory for patriarchy, rape culture, and started looking at some of the reviews, and it quickly became apparent that we were in the severe minority of people who understood the film in
this
particular way. And so I think a big part of what drew us to the film was less the film itself, which is itself obviously brilliant, but the way in which so many other people saw it so differently, and that our own recognition of what we saw was so unlike that of mainstream critics and generally just people on the internet talking about the film.
Yeah, would you say that I missed my guess in terms of what most people were talking about? I mean, I've mentioned this many times. I mentioned in the trailer to this series and everything else that I am by no means a film critic. I am doing this in large part for fun and to gain a deeper understanding of the movies that I love. But would you say that I'm right in saying that most people see it as an allegory for sexually transmitted diseases and kind of miss the notes that you saw?
Absolutely. We analyzed over 220 different film reviews of It Follows. We did that by studying reviews on YouTube, pulling out reviews from newspapers across the United States, as well as indexing Rotten Tomatoes reviews. And we found that around 14 people even recognized that this film was an allegory about rape culture or patriarchy. The vast, vast majority of reviews reviewed it as though the film is about sexually transmitted infections. And we saw the film so radically differently that we couldn't quite grapple with that. And so what ended up happening is we became really invested in studying how the reviews dealt with the material within the film that we see as clearly about grappling with rape culture.
Right. So let me ask you this. The things that you saw that made it so clearly about rape culture, because I'll admit I missed those as well until we all had a conversation a couple of weeks ago about some of the visuals in the movie, of Jay being tied to the chair, of the character Hugh kind of getting a pass on what he did. He becomes almost a sympathetic character. What are the kinds of things that you see in the movie that led you to that conclusion? Because critical scholars, for people who are unfamiliar with critical communication research, and I'll allow you two to define it too, because I'll probably get it damn wrong, but they are very good at digging out these themes that we're talking about. They have a nose for these kinds of things that people who have a casual view of a movie might miss. So what are the things that you saw in the movie that made your kind of ears perk up and go, well, wait a minute, this is about rape. This isn't about STIs, it's about rape. What do you see?
Well, the first things we see very early on in the film is that Jay is constantly dealing with peeping Toms in the neighborhood. There are two neighborhood boys who are trying to catch her undressed or trying to watch her while she's swimming. That continues with throughout the film, that there are different aspects of surveillance. Even her friend Paul, who is trying to help her, very much is using what's happening to her as a way to get closer to her. But right. Perhaps the biggest scene where we saw rape as the main allegory is the scene where Hugh ties Jay up in a wheelchair. What's interesting to us about that scene is that Hugh views his violence as absolutely necessary. And what he does is he chloroforms her and ties her up to a wheelchair, right? And keeps her in her underwear in order to show her this monster that is coming to get her. But later in the film, Jay finds Hugh at his parents' house and has a really casual conversation about what's happening to her and what this monster could potentially be or do to her. And that contrast between those two scenes, as a viewer, really lets us know that Hugh viewed violence against this young woman as absolutely essential to his survival. And because he prioritized that, you really see the power dynamics of misogyny and patriarchy and rape culture at play.
So you kind of saw Hugh's actions as, I used the term in our discussion as they were almost excused, but rather than being excused, you would see them as almost being part and parcel of kind of the morals in this world, and really a reflection of the morals we have in our own world. We excuse sexual aggression. We excuse misogyny and patriarchy. Is that kind of the point of the article that you were making? Or rather, that was what you saw, and that was what you were surprised other people didn't see?
I don't know if it was so much surprise. I think we had an initial surprise, and then we have to remind ourselves that these are things that we are, in fact, both trained and paid to look for, right? This is literally our job to try to look in ways that not everyone always looks. For me, anyway, it was I've sort of long been interested in the mediated representations of rape culture since I worked on a paper that I never ended up being able to do anything with in grad school about rape myths and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the initial interaction with Hugh I almost immediately, following the being tied up, was like, that's rape by deception, right? That's not part of rape culture. That's not sexual violence adjacent. That's straight up rape. There's a specific kind of it found in the law. And so for me, it was an obvious, hey, this is both the way that rape myths get propagated, but another interesting angle for us to look at. This will for sure be something that I don't think most people are going to see when they are watching this.
Now, do you see, I mean, the scenes with Jay being tied to the wheelchair, being subjected to kind of surveillance from the Peeping Tom kids, who I think show up again later as it, if I remember right. One of them shows up as the monster later in the movie. But there are other scenes, too, that kind of allude to these sorts of things. There's a scene where I forget the character's name, but it's the one that Jay is clearly attracted to, other than Paul. He's killed later in the movie by it. It takes the form of his mother, and then all you see is kind of this aggressive humping on this character. Did that raise any flags for the two of you, a scene like that?
Absolutely. If you engage with our article, you'll see a number of different of these elements that we're sort of pulling out. But it's really clear, both that scene where Greg, the neighbor, is assaulted to death by his own mother in a fashion that looks very reminiscent of rape, as well as the it's within the film itself sometimes look like they've been sexually assaulted. So the first one that Jay sees inside her home is a woman whose clothes have been torn off, whose breast is exposed, who looks like she's gotten out of a violent fight. And throughout the film, you see this repeated effort to demonstrate that there is a great culture of misogyny and assault that's sort of surrounding Jay and trying to envelop her in this world. And that's where we see all of these links throughout the film.
What role do you see her friends playing? Because they're ever-present as well, and they play kind of a supporting cast, but they also are victimized a bit.
Yeah, I think that her friends are trying to be as sympathetic as they can, but they fully don't understand what's happening. And that's where I see that allegory of, like, her pain is hers. When her date with Hugh ends, he dumps her in the middle of the street in front of her house, and her sisters and her friend Paul come out to help her. After that, the police show up and they ask her, was it consensual? And she says, yes. And in that scene, you see the people around her trying desperately to understand what she's been going through, but not fully being able to make that connection because it's so personal to her.
Right. There are several scenes where you see Jay after the scene where Hugh rapes her. Using the terminology that we've been using, where she reacts in a way that almost seems like it would be rape PTSD. Like, there's a scene specifically where she's in her class at her college and looks out the window and she sees it kind of coming toward her. And, like, on the surface, that's what's making her react. But if you take it out of that equation and you see how she's reacting, that seems very much like somebody who would react to post-traumatic stress disorder after having been raped. I mean, are there other scenes where you see her react to it or something else that make her act that way?
Precisely. Some of the scenes at the beach, when the kids go to the beach, she's trying to demonstrate that she sees this terror, but none of her friends can see this terror. And so part of that moment when another character is assaulted by it trying to kill Jay sort of demonstrates to us that the way that Jay is experiencing this is quite different than other people in the area are. And she's demonstrating once again that trauma that she's experienced and that she's terrified.
Well, and there's even some scenes later in the film where even the efforts to prevent it from getting to her, so floating in the pool later on, almost looks like how we might understand the dissociation that comes with PTSD of sexual violence, and how even in those efforts to combat the it, that she's manifesting a set of displays that are almost unrecognizable from how a rape survivor might appear.
Right. So in addition to that, the additional way she's reacting, there are a couple of scenes in the movie that, I mean, I don't know how to categorize them, but I'd be interested to hear how this works in your framework and whether or not the rape culture angle can explain this. And let's start with the anachronistic nature of the movie. For those that aren't academics out there, anachronistic just means that you can't tell what time this movie takes place. Like it feels like the 1980s, primarily because of what I think is a brilliant soundtrack and a brilliant score. But there are scenes where one of Jay's friends is looking at a little, like a seashell Kindle, reading a book, which she was reading Kafka, but we can get to that. But what do you make of the anachronistic nature of the movie? The fact that we can't really tell when this is taking place.
The nature of out of time, out of place kinds of ambient activities and scenes in both films like this generally, but here specifically, both invite audiences to be able to more easily identify with both the nostalgia of a previous time, but also the possibility that this can be speaking for the time that they are currently at. And so it's part movie-making trick in terms of making for a wider set of audiences that might get drawn into the film. But
yeah, they got me.
Right? But it also sets it up relatively well to make it so that the way that you think of the film is simultaneously in the future and in the past while actually talking about the now.
So that begs the question, something that a question I had written down to ask you, does that mean that, and I mean, the answer to this we obviously know is yes, but is the movie trying to convey that this kind of rape culture, misogyny, this kind of, psychological and physical violence, it's permanent. It's part of who we are, and it's part of what this world is trying to convey. It's trying to be a mirror on us and reflect what we are across time.
Absolutely. The film is part of the atmospheric horror tradition, which started around the time that the film started coming out, so in the 2010s era. And atmospheric horror does what Dr. Varda mentioned, right? It tries to draw you in and make you feel connected to the characters. But because the horror is all around the characters and therefore seeping into where you are sitting as the audience member, it not only makes what you're watching feel comfortable to you, but it also renders it strange, right? So that's where we were so interested in why this film is really interesting in terms of how it depicts rape culture, because of the way that it sort of draws attention to the horror of everyday life of living within rape culture.
That setting also did something in this particular film that kind of reminded us of another set of movies that we actually had written about, was Paranormal Activity, in terms of it invites the audience to start scanning everywhere for what is background and what is part of the story, and now I'm invested, and where is the it, especially because it can come from anywhere. And the discombobulation of the audience is partially critical to inviting them into becoming active participants in the anticipation of where is the it coming from.
And maybe, I mean, you're the experts on this, but maybe by giving the audience kind of that psychological and even the visual, the discombobulation, like that might put you in a space on what it might feel like in the aftermath of, I don't want to say that somebody who's discombobulated is even anywhere in the same field as somebody who was raped, but somebody who was assaulted or underwent a trauma might experience the world that way, where things are out of place. They feel like you can't categorize things where they belong. All these things seem like they would be natural responses to that kind of trauma.
I think that atmospheric horror is really trying to play on our common psychological experiences, right? So if we think about that all of us will experience trauma, that sexual assault is incredibly common, unfortunately, right? Mm-hmm. That atmospheric horror is really trying to render that feeling of, I need to be able to trust someone, and yet every single person could be a monster, is nevertheless a really important message that reflects back the misogyny and recalcitrance of rape culture.
Yeah. Yeah. So that begs the question, the big question that everybody asks on every podcast episode or every YouTube video or every thought piece about It Follows. I'll start with what is it, but I have a follow-up to that that doesn't get asked, and I'll be really curious to hear your answer to it. What do you two peg as being it in this?
I think the it in It Follows is the figure of a monster that is prevalent, that can be anyone, anywhere. And because of that, I think that this film is a representation or a reflection on rape culture.
Scott?
I'm going to say similar, but I'm going to maybe be almost more pointed about it in that I think that you can draw it in a bunch of different ways, in both as we saw it as a reflection of rape culture, but it could also be understood, depending on the theorist that you're interested in following down the line, but in terms of a drive toward death, in terms of the ever-present crushing of modern capitalism, the connection of the disalienation of all of us from society, and it becomes a singular manifestation of dread that functions as a sexually violent entity. And so I don't even know that it needs to be a singular thing, and that might make it the most scary thing of all.
Mary Wilde would love that answer. She's a Freudian cinema expert, and you would love her work, and she would love yours. I'm going to point you toward each other's work, but she would love that answer because she thinks a lot of films that have to do with almost the certainty of death, they have to do with this death drive. And I think there's a lot of credence in that, because the book that the friend is reading on the little seashell Kindle, I think it's The Idiot, if I remember right, from Kafka. And at the end of the movie, she reads this line that talks about the only thing certain, no matter what you do, is this impending death. And this that there's everything, every trauma we endure, everything relates to or pushes us toward this death drive. So I think there's a lot of credence to lend to that idea.
I would argue that that death drive is also a demonstration that the death drive does not equally impact different people, and that the film is drawing attention to the way marginalized subjects are impacted by that death drive. There's a really key scene in the conclusion of the film where Paul and Jay are driving in downtown Detroit, and Paul looks over and sees two sex workers downtown. And that moment is a key moment in the film where they're sort of trying to reinscribe the different ways that we look at marginalized peoples in relationship to that threat.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident they chose Detroit, because they have the suburbs and then they have the downtown, which is torn up. I noticed that point too. I didn't know what it meant, but I did take note of that. It seemed almost like a throwaway scene, but it definitely seemed like something worth noting. And it seemed like Paul, being kind of a white kid from the suburbs, who despite going his friend going through this experience is pretty privileged, he's able, if he wanted to just kind of pass the problem along to the underprivileged, this being the sex workers.
Absolutely. And I think that reflects not only I don't know that we care so much about what the author actually intends, but the director explicitly describes how they want the ending to be up to how the audience sees it and make sort of a untidy endings of their own, like many horror films do. But that particular one, in that moment, both Jay and Paul have had sex, so presumably Paul is able to transmit the curse at that point. And for sure, it's almost a sizing up of, do I think that these are people deserving of the curse? Meaning, are these people that are less than in some way? And in lots of ways, that reflects sort of the underlying recognizability that underlines what we were describing in terms of notions of precarity and how it is differentially felt between folks. Sexual violence threatens almost everyone. The concern, though, is that many different bodies have that threat differentially applied and threatened to them, which means that notions of ability and race and class and sex and gender and orientation all go into the collective matrix of who is quote-unquote deserving to have that cruelty be inflicted upon them by the misrecognition of whether or not someone is human enough.
And I think that also cycles back to what we see from Hugh, in that we see Hugh become almost, or at least in the eyes of the camera or what the audience is meant to see, like a sympathetic character. But he's also this white kid, ostensibly. Well, he says he's from the suburbs. Kind of his origins are a little bit mysterious. But he also has privileges that people who aren't white and who don't live where he lives, like they don't have the privileges he has. So when Jay and her friends have this conversation with him, it seems like, oh, well, yeah, he didn't deserve this curse either, despite the fact that he raped Jay.
No, he for sure almost becomes this Brock Turner style, able to be, we're supposed to in some way feel sorry for the fact that he, in fact, engaged in saving himself by functionally trying to kill Jay.
Yeah, and there's a separate movie. We don't talk about it this series because it came out a little bit later. But The Menu, in the movie The Menu, if you've seen that, there's the character, the main character, well, not the main character. The main character is Anya Taylor-Joy's character. But she is a sex worker who somebody who knew that he was putting her in danger took her to this dinner. But it's essentially sexual violence, or at least violence through misdirection and lying, in a similar type way. There's no evidence they actually had sex, but he feels that she is worthy of the punishment that's going to come her way, in the same way that it seems like this guy thinks the same thing of Jay. Hugh thinks of Jay.
I love the way that particular film, and I won't spoil anything because it is relatively recent-ish. Mm-hmm. So for your audience, if you have an opportunity, that's a phenomenal film, and the ending is incredibly satisfying.
Very satisfying. It has a lot to say about class culture, too. It has a lot to say about class culture. It has a lot to say about kind of culinary culture and how certain populations have access to it, in kind of the same way that It Follows talks about kind of the way that two different classes of people kind of live within the same place. It's very, very interesting, and also really, really funny. I thought The Menu was hysterically funny.
Agree.
We agree.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. This is it went in the category of neither of us have time to write about that right now because we both have like six different projects. But for sure, we finished it and thought, oh, this could we no, we have to stop having this conversation because we've got eight other things happening right now.
When I saw on the, I mean, well, I'll probably talk about this in a later series if anybody listens to this series. But when I saw Tyler's bullshit show up on the screen to describe what he created in the kitchen, I absolutely lost it. I love that movie. So I have a follow-up to the big question people, and like that question, what is it? That's not a very creative question, because that's, you see that in every review, and that's where kind of that sexually transmitted infection argument comes from. Coming from that, the question that I want to ask is, what does it mean, follow? What does follows mean? What does it mean? Like, I mean, follows ostensibly means, you know, these things chase you no matter where you're going to go. But it strikes me that given what we've talked about and kind of the trauma of rape and the kinds of things that Jay goes through and other characters go through, is there another meaning for follows here? Can we interpret that in a different way?
I think what follows is the omnipresent threat of death. Because when Jay meets up with Hugh a second time, he tells her that he can still see the monster. She mm-hmm. and Paul can both still see the monster. So there's not necessarily any immediate protection for any of the people who have been affected by this monster. So what I think is happening is that the fear is going to constantly pursue them, that they can't leave behind these traumatic events, that they will always be with them. And again, that's why we see the corollary to rape culture, that trauma does not go away. It is something that has to be made room for, that has to be accounted for and dealt with.
And in some ways, that particular nature of being able to see the trauma almost was reminiscent of the ones who walk away, the Ursula Le Guin the story about your recognition of your society is fundamentally built on the torture of another, and so it became very much a way of you have temporarily displaced the precarity from yourself, but you right. still see the horror that you have inflicted on other people. And so it's not simply that the entity is chasing someone else. It's the knowledge of that entity that continues to haunt you even after you're not next in line to be killed.
So you're, in that way, for the people who are capable of feeling it, what follows, or what follows might mean, might be, as Leslie said, the ever presence of death, which is always there, and almost the ever presence of the knowledge of what one has done wrong and guilt, if they're capable of feeling it, because the movie tries to convey that Hugh feels bad for what he's doing. I think he apologizes several times when he ties her to the wheelchair. There's several times he apologizes when they speak in the front yard, which again, kind of, it just reeks of somebody apologizing for assault. What it reminded me of, honestly, when we had our first conversation, it's not a horror movie, but there is a movie from the late 90s called Higher Learning. And there's a scene where an individual, he rapes a freshman at the college and then tries to apologize profusely to her over the phone, then kind of in person. And that's what it felt like. That's what it felt like Hugh was doing.
And that film is so interesting. I had to watch that film as part of my college orientation.
Same.
Different
colleges.
And so again, this is a really good moment where we can say films are meant to reflect on the cultures that young people are experiencing. And this film, much like Higher Learning, is demonstrating how assault is experienced and some of the ways that those experiences might be common across lots of different people.
Yeah. So with the movie, we've covered quite a bit, but there are the things that I was always interested in with this movie, and what really made me love this movie, and I think consistent with Scott, I love kind of a blurry ending. I love drawing my own conclusions about a movie, having just enough narrative bait to draw my own conclusions. But there are a couple of things at the end that I've never really known how to interpret. And I think with this angle, the rape culture angle, you might have answers to this. Number one, something I still have not ever gotten a satisfying answer. I've never read a satisfying answer about. What's going on at the end of the movie in the pool when they finally get it, whatever it is, in the pool? It's shot in the head and kind of the blood takes over the pool. You see the blood spread out and it feels threatening, but it's never really explained why. Do you have any ideas about that whatsoever?
One, that scene is really interesting because the it in that moment is Jay's deceased father.
Right. And that's not obvious. Right.
It's not obvious. You have to like watch it many times to even catch that. There's this scene when she lays over the edge of the pool. She's exhausted from trying to defeat it. And she sees the blood coming towards her. And the blood coming towards her is foreshadowing that her death or something of her life must be paid in order to get away from this monster.
I almost don't want to dress it up. I mean, I can go both directions here. I simultaneously can do there might have simply been a deleted scene where someone tried to escape from the pool and had been killed as a result. And that's just, you know, one of the small flaws in an otherwise brilliant film. But at the same time, I can also see more of sort of a larger, it's the diffusion of the it within the pool, and only when it is concretized in a specific locale does it actually present physical danger to anyone, even though it is an ever-present threat everywhere.
Okay. Okay, I can get on board with that. It's just something that I actually like there's a deleted scene thing because it seems so out of place, and the threatening nature of it seemed very out of place to me. But both of those arguments, I think, they hold water.
The only other thing, I think that the blood in the pool also symbolizes that Jay's father, I think the blood in the pool could also point to the idea that Jay is visualizing her father being killed in that moment, and that is what is traumatizing to her in that moment.
Okay. I can get on board with that as well. I mean, there's no evidence that Jay's father assaulted her, is there? I mean, I considered that after we talked the first time. But I was thinking about the entirety of the pool scene. I was thinking if there was anything there that lended any kind of credence to that. Was there any evidence that her father assaulted her at all?
I did not see any evidence in the film that would point to that. But it's an interesting read, and I wonder if it could be discovered.
I have no idea. But I mean, if we're talking about the different kinds of ways that people experience sexual trauma, I mean, unfortunately, sexual assault by family member is one of the most common. So, I mean, again, I'm not trying to besmirch the good name of Jay's deceased father. It's just something that came to mind when they brought him back to be it in that last scene.
No, I had the same thought, but I didn't see anything else in the film that would support that interpretation.
Except for maybe the scene where the guy across the street is being assaulted by his mother. That was such a disturbing scene. I mean, it disturbing beyond some of the other scenes in the movie. It doesn't connect directly to Jay's father, but just something I think to think about the next time I watch it, which I'll probably do tonight now.
I was just going to say that there's also a number of other sort of fan theories bopping around about the particular film, and one of them holds that most of, if though not exclusively, most of the iterations of it in the film are adults. And since almost all of the characters in the film are kids, it becomes sort of a coming of age story where part of what might be the monster is the ever presence of adulthood more generally.
That's really interesting. I hadn't considered that. I'm trying to think, when is it a kid? I think the one time when they're at the beach, when he kind of pokes his head through the shotgun hole in the wall, but I think that's it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the only time that the it is a child, and that is only because an adult wouldn't fit through that small hole.
That's correct. And that child was one of the ones that was peeping on Jay in the beginning, wasn't it?
Yes, that is the same peeping Tom in the neighborhood.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's definitely something to be said there about the form that it takes is always some kind of threat, not just in terms of bodily harm, but in a threat in terms of someone who has the ability to assault or rape or otherwise, traumatize the person. Although when Jay's in her classroom, it's an old woman coming from what looks like a hospital, so she doesn't fit the pattern. But I mean, there's so many different ways to interpret it.
There are different ways that these sort of monsters come forward, that they represent different things at different times in the film. And so it's not surprising that it transforms from a version of Greg into Greg's mom. And all of these different transformations are meant to show how close the terror is, that it is always present and always extremely close to home.
And we haven't even talked about the fact that it takes the form, which I think is the creepiest one, when they leave the house and drive away, of a tall, naked man on Jay's roof. I think it's Jay's roof. But somebody gets butt-ass naked on a roof looking at her, which, again, now that I think about it, look at it through the lens that the two of you look at it through, it makes a lot of sense why that guy had no clothes on.
Right. Full frontal male nudity is not very common in horror films, not as common as other forms of nudity. And so, yeah, that moment is really clear, I think, in terms of that threat is sexual in nature.
Yeah. Yeah. So, kind of the last question that I would love to hear your interpretation on, you kind of alluded to it, I think Scott alluded to it, is kind of at the end, what it is and what follows means. They kind of come together in this last scene where Jay and Paul are kind of walking hand in hand down the street, and we have this weird, threatening, over-the-shoulder camera angle where it seems as though something is following them. What do you make of that last scene? Is that meant to tell us that they'll never be free of what it is that they've experienced?
This film uses a 360-degree shot in many of the scenes where it is following Jay. And that choice is really strategic. It's not used very frequently in horror films, and it's used expertly in this film. And that 360-degree shot also is meant to mimic the audience's need for surveillance, that you need to look around you constantly. End of the film, that it's a similar shot, but it's not a 360-degree shot. And so I think that the director's choice to not use the 360-degree shot, but to use these over-the-shoulder sort of moments, is an effort at saying there's hope. Right? Because the 360-degree shot is used when there is the most amount of danger. And so for me, I think that conclusion moment is that they could survive, but we just don't know if they'll be successful at surviving.
I'm going to say something similar. Robert Mitchell, was the writer and director, sort of said that they played with a bunch of different endings for the ending of the film and wanted to leave it at up to the audience to understand how this film ended. And I'm going to say something similar to Leslie, but I think what I'm going to suggest is that it leaves open the possibility that they are, in fact, looking for other people, hence the sex worker shot, pass it on to, but also the possibility that they have simply resigned themselves to the eternal struggle against trying to avoid this thing together. And in some level, even though that particular ending opens itself up to a kind of depressing that is what you are open to, it almost relieves the potential guilt of those of the actors from engaging in any kind of tidy ending that saves them, and instead says, we want to be ethical actors in some fashion, and even if that nature of ethical action means that we have to engage in a constant struggle for our own survival.
Wow, I did not peg that at all. I was looking at it as, I saw it as a depressing ending, and the fact, not just that I perceive it as they're always going to be looking over their shoulder for it coming, but first of all, let me say I like both of your interpretations better than mine, because mine is depressing in two ways. Number one, I did interpret it the first time I saw it as they'll never be clear of it. And this has nothing to do with rape culture or misogyny. It's just that they'll never be clear of this, on the surface, the monster. It's always going to be pursuing them. But something else that depressed me about the ending, and I don't know if anybody else ever picked this up, was that Jay didn't want Paul. Jay didn't want to have sex with Paul. She eventually felt as though she had to take him up on his offer. And then they were kind of in this relationship at the end where it seemed like Jay was almost a prisoner in the relationship. Like, she felt obligated to be with him at that point. I mean, I interpreted it that way. And Paul was happy, yeah, but I felt like Jay was given a raw deal because she was forced into a corner on the basis of her trauma. And like you said earlier, Paul kind of capitalized on that trauma by being the, quote, nice guy. I don't know. I felt like Jay never really got a happy ending in this movie.
I don't think it's a winning ending for anyone. Neither Jay nor Paul wins the film, right? And so I think you're right that Jay did not want to be with Paul, and we don't see evidence that she is attracted to him at any point, but that they are stuck together at the end.
Right.
But I think that their most popular reading of the ending of the film is that they are going to die, or that they are going to be terrorized for the rest of their lives. So I do think that's possibly true, but I think that there's a little bit more hope that they could navigate it together. So yeah, I'm not sure that there's a good, tidy way of explaining that, but that there is a threat that they have to manage forever.
I agree. And I should note, too, that there is a sequel coming out to It Follows called They Follow. So I'm not sure when that's coming out, but it says that photography starts in 24.
Yeah, I've heard that's coming out in 25, but we'll see.
I was going to say, I kind of tend to lean into your understanding of the relationship between Paul and Jay, in as much as, and I always sort of go back to my early women's studies classes here. I think Marilyn Fry described it as like a bird in a cage situation, that Paul almost becomes a protector from the larger sexual violence that Jay can have inflicted upon her, but isn't actually happy or fulfilled within that relationship. She almost just settles for Paul as a, this is who I need to be with in order to be somewhat safe.
It follows is clearly only... The purpose of this first series is to talk about movies and what I call kind of the horror renaissance. And I think, Leslie, you talked about it as kind of ambient horror really made its emergence in the mid-2010s and has had its moment. And it's still ongoing now. At this moment right now, we're recording on June 30th, and Long Legs comes out in a few weeks. And that looks like it's going to be kind of the pinnacle of ambient horror from what I can tell. But... given the kind of themes that we saw in It Follows, the themes that you talked about, are there other kinds of films that you would recommend to listeners to seek out that talk about the kind of the same things or that they might interpret in the same way?
Well, first I need to say that It Follows is very unique as a film, but there are other films that are very similar in terms of the themes about rape culture, atmospheric or ambient horror, and participate in that 2010 sort of revamp of the horror film. So I want to say first is we need to talk about Kevin from 2011.
Oh, great show.
Right? That's a Lynn Ramsey film. It's amazing. Please watch it. Then The Guest from 2014, which is an Adam Wingard film about a soldier who presents himself as a deceased son's friend. Amazing film.
Haven't seen that one.
You must watch it. It Comes at Night in 2017. It's a Trey Edwards Schultz film. Amazing. And then just a few more. Promising Young Woman from 2020. Obviously an amazing film. And has that same kind of atmospheric, ambient horror of the main character. Hereditary from 2018.
Which my favorite.
Is a wonderful
also
film.
The series.
Yes. Also a wonderful film for dealing with how... what is our body? How do we control our body? How vulnerable are we in our bodies? And then the last one I'll say is The Perfection from 2018. It's a Richard Shepard film about cellists. It's a little gritty, but it's a really great film that sort of delves into some of these same themes. Oh, also The Babadook.
The Babadook is a fan favorite. Scott, do you have any?
I would go a different direction. my love of horror is always generally grounded in the unique and what has done things differently. And I think part of that is the reason that we collectively can look at a film like It Follows as such a successful film, is that it incorporated so many other aspects of other work. And I'm not really going to focus on newer stuff. I'm going to do several throwbacks, in fact. One of the early ones that is a classic for a reason is both Alien and Aliens. Needs
fantastic.
To be studied for any amount of time that you can have that available. But the other, and maybe this is I grew up on a Nightmare on Elm Street diet, and so I've always, right, I've always been interested in sort of the campy and the intentional misdirection of horror rather than slasher or jump scares per se. Scream and Cabin in the Woods.
Cabin in the Woods is so good.
I think the entire Scream franchise is fantastic in that respect, and Cabin in the Woods does a phenomenal job of almost doing Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show, on steroids with the knowledge of 10 years after that, and to have the self-awareness to engage in all of the previous genre aspects and sort of play with them and make fun of them.
Oh yeah, Cabin in the Woods is essentially that. It's a film. It's what Evil Dead would be if somebody who watched 20 years of horror made Evil Dead and used it as a commentary on the way that we consume horror. I love the Cabin in the Woods, and I love the first couple of Screams as well. And I also, full disclosure, those boxes, the box art that I talked about. Nightmare on Elm Street was my first real foray into horror in the 80s because I saw the box art. Nightmare on Elm Street 3, the box art is badass, and that's what made me start with it.
Yes, I think Nightmare on Elm Street was also my introduction to horror. I wasn't allowed to be watching it, but I definitely was.
My buddy, my best friend, we grew up watching Faces of Death. Like, we weren't supposed to watch it. It was like the true horror, like actually watching people die before we were like maybe 8 or 9 years old. So this is like before YouTube. So we would get these tapes, we'd rent these tapes, and it was meant to be like actual films of people dying. And it says a lot about the work that I do that I watched that when I was 8 and 9 years old.
I think all of us have been heavily desensitized at this point, and that can be a useful professional professional skill.
I would say that real life is way scarier than any horror movie you can watch at this point.
I think we would agree with you, which is why we both study horror films and popular culture.
All right, so with that said, where can anybody interested in the work that you do, where can we find more of your work? I mean, do you have a social media following? And I'm going to, for any listeners interested, I'm going to be posting the article. Can you also, I had the article up here. I think I accidentally turned it off or closed the tab. Can you go ahead and say the name of the article that I found that we based this episode on? And where can everybody find your other work as well?
Sure. This particular article is It Follows and Rape Culture, Critical Response as Disavowal, which appeared in Women's Studies in Communication in 2017. You can find our work in a whole host of locales. Recently, we both wrote about the flag that the Alitos flew outside their house.
We have a piece in The Conversation about that. And so we have several public-facing pieces that are really interesting. And I will also add that we are working on a book on representations of rape culture and how they entrench or help resist the patterns of rape culture. That won't be out for another couple years, but it should be coming soon.
And I will also say that Dr. Stuckey would be upset if we didn't also say Deliberating the Declaration will be out in 2025, and we both have a chapter in that book that discusses how we collectively use the Declaration of Independence as a way to write about and talk about our present issues in the world.
Excellent. So what I'll do is with the books that come out later and the chapters that come out later, I can always update the descriptions of these episodes wherever you get them, whether it be on Spotify or Apple Music. So when those books come out, I will update the descriptions so people can find them on Amazon or wherever the publisher has them.
Cool. And if you're interested in any pine tree things, let us know. We have all the intel.
We'll be sure to do so. Well, Leslie, Scott, thank you so much for coming on here and giving us the perspective that you gave us. There's so much literature and so much written about It Follows, and I don't think I've seen any of it that talks about the angle that you come from. So thank you very, very much for talking to me about this.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're very welcome. We really enjoyed it.